begin? 'Cause of course I've got you under my skin.
This is KPOO San Francisco 89.5 FM. You've reached Reality Sandwich. I'm Julie Matthews. I'm a certified nutrition consultant.
And I'm Martin Matthews. I'm a certified medical hypnotherapist and healthful living advocate.
You are listening to Healthful Living's radio show, Reality Sandwich, A Palatable Taste of the Truth. And today we have on Arthur Sierra Micoli. And he is the author of Performance Addiction, The Dangerous New Syndrome, and How to Stop It from Ruining Your Life. So right now, I am going to see if we can get him on the line. Arthur, are you there?
Hi, Julie. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Wonderful.
Vacationing on the southern coast of Maine, how can I complain?
That's right. Well, good for you. So We have your book. We read your book. It's very interesting, and actually it segues in great from a show that Martin did last week talking about similar concepts.
Just to fill you in, last week's show we were embroiled in a really deep discussion in helping us understand the difference between guilt and shame, and how guilt has to do with our behaviors and shame has to do with our implicating our inner core being. And then I got your book last week, and I've been tearing through it, and your book is called Performance Addiction, The Dangerous New Syndrome, and How to Stop It from Ruining Your Life. Mm-hmm. So I just would love to dive into this a little bit about some background in the book, if you could share that with our listeners, and what do you mean by performance addiction? When I think of that, I'm thinking I've got to be in a marathon every weekend. I've got to be the best in my class. Performance. Please share with our listeners and us a bit about what this is about the book.
Sure. Well, performance addiction, Martin, is the belief that perfecting appearance and achieving status will secure love and respect. It's an irrational belief system that becomes hardwired from early experiences, and it's reinforced by cultural expectations. My first recognition of performance addiction came about largely as a result of my work with a group of individuals who embodied so many of the qualities that are highly regarded in professional and public life. Their resumes were very impressive, but I noticed that despite their capabilities, that they seemed to have little regard for their personal achievements in their own physical appearance. They all seem to be what I call scoreboard watchers. Every day they take inventory of how well or how terribly they're performing, or how attractive, how dreadful they looked in the mirror. Men seem particularly preoccupied with money, achieving more status, and acquiring more prestigious positions. Many of the women were self-conscious about appearance, that their looks seemed to be the potential ticket to happiness. Then there were the men and women who transcended gender lines, and as I probe further, I realized that a new kind of addiction was occurring, and I've come to realize that it's rampant in our society. It's affecting the way we work, the way we love, and most importantly, the way we parent.
Hmm. Now, what's the difference between this, because you state you're right here in the front of the book, dangerous new syndrome. So you're identifying something fairly new, a new phenomenon that we're identifying within our society. Yeah. How does this differ, and how are these people different than what we have in the past identified as, you know, type A people or, sure, you know, very hyper, have to be successful kind of folks?
Yeah, that's a very important question, because people sometimes confuse this with type A personalities. For one is, type A personalities can have a dimmer switch. I mean, we learn from more research that there are two kinds of perfectionists. There is a perfectionist who really has a phenomenal ability, and they like to actualize that ability, but they have a dimmer switch. They're able to turn the dial down when they're not working. Type A personalities also are not particularly focused on appearance necessarily. They may be focused on their work, but not focused on not being able to stop comprehensively in their life. Performance addiction is really focused on the two driving forces in our society right now, which are appearance and status, appearance and achievement. So type A personalities aren't necessarily preoccupied with their appearance, and they can have a down time in their life. They can have that dimmer switch where they know how to turn the dial down, but they can turn it up when they need to. So this is more of a belief system that really fundamentally says if you don't look the right way and if you don't perform on a certain level that gathers a certain status and respect from other people, you won't be lovable and you won't be respected in our society.
Now, I have a couple of quick questions here. Now, I'm curious, number one, how this has come about. How do people get this way? And what are some simple examples? Like, how would we know, maybe one of us knows somebody who is exhibiting this kind of behavior, or perhaps it's even ourselves. How do we identify that? What's an example of someone that's dealing with performance addiction?
Performance addicts, they turn to activity like alcoholics turn to a drink, like gamblers are drawn to the gambling table. And if they're not distractedly busy, they don't feel worthy. And when good performance doesn't buy them happiness, they think they must perform even better. And then when that fails to deliver, they decide to try harder, go faster, be more dedicated, and make more sacrifices. And that's the nature of addiction. I have a number of, the example that I like the most is I tell this story in a chapter called The Lure of Glamour, which particularly focuses on men, of a fellow who titled the story, He Doesn't Fly Alone. He's in one of my performance addiction groups, Ivy League graduate, star college athlete, working for a major corporation, making a lot of money, but can't slow down. He really does not have the ability to slow down because he's always afraid that other people will get ahead. He was making a trip to California in which he was having to give a keynote speech out there involving a merger with another company, and he asked me in a performance addiction group what could he do to calm down? How could he not, you know, turn on the laptop and be so preoccupied and worried and about what he was going to say, and often has an insomnia night the night before he talks? And I said, why don't you practice what we've been trying to do in group, which is establish the capacity for empathy, kind of lose yourself, which is what performance addicts have difficulty doing, slowing down and actually listening and entering into the world of another. And that's what empathy does. It sort of gives us a mental vacation from our own troubles. Well, on this flight, he's sitting next to a woman, and he thought of my words and the group's words, and he closed the laptop, and he usually doesn't strike up a conversation with anyone. In this instance, he said to the woman next to him, he started a conversation about some small talk, and then he mentioned that he was anxious, and she said, you know, I'm very anxious too. This is my first time back at work and flying in a month. And he asked her, well, how come? And she went on to tell him that her son had died. Her 19-year-old son had passed away. In fact, he had overdosed, and he was a star athlete, and he had gone off to college, and he died of a cocaine ingestion. It actually stopped his heart, and she had no idea that he was using drugs. To make a long story short, this conversation went on, in which he really engrossed himself in this story, and she ultimately was telling him that the day of the funeral, this boy's younger brother had a cross-country meet, and his uncles encouraged him in that afternoon of the funeral to go run, to do this for his brother, and he didn't really want to. But he did go, and he did run, and he was not obviously the best athlete on the track that day, but the other athletes, as he was coming into, you know, you run out into a woods in cross-country, and you come into a track, and as he was coming into the stadium, the other athletes let him go ahead of them, and they all started clapping. And my patient, as he was telling this story, was tearing. He was almost sobbing and having trouble describing this event of this profound experience he had with this woman. And normally he would tend to drink on a trip like this or chew tobacco, something to settle himself down. And he said the whole trip, he realized that at the end, he was totally calm, and that he had entered the world of another person. He had used this capacity for empathy, and it had turned off his performance addiction. And in fact, he gave the best talk that he had given in some months, and he came back, and as he was relating it to the group, he was also saying that this had calmed him down. Even relating the story, it had still laughed. It was still living in his heart.
Oh, wow. Let's just clarify for our listeners. You mentioned your clients and group. You are a clinical psychologist.
Yes.
And instructor of psychology at the Harvard Medical School as well.
Yes.
And you have been, this book is a composite of many, many years of your client work in this area, is that right?
Well, it's actually a sequel to a book that I published, Martin, in 2000, was called The Power of Empathy. And because I really believe empathy is part of the process of recovery for performance addicts. It's really developing these interpersonal skills that allow us to get the love and respect we want from other people. And we know that people who have the highest capacity for empathy are more successful in the professional and personal world. And oftentimes, people with performance addiction think that the only thing that impresses other people is what they do, not who they are, not how they can be present in a conversation with another person. So I really noticed this syndrome, particularly in the last 5 years. Mm. And as I titled the introduction, The Curse of the Capable, these people tend to be very capable people, very well-meaning people that just so misdirected in terms of what brings love and respect in life.
Sure, sure. I'd like to jump into that a little bit more now about the curse of the capable. But I had one question just before that about what, you know, the driver, the fuel here for this ongoing performance. Is it, would you say, more of an inner drive to achieve something that if I continue to perform, I will have something and feel a certain way, or perhaps is it more motivated by the need to avoid something, avoid pain, avoid humiliation, or is it some sort of combination of both, perhaps?
Well, I think that that's an interesting point, because I think to some degree all addictions are an avoidance of some emotional pain. And in this case, it is an avoidance of not really receiving the kind of empathy and love and acceptance for who you are, your own character. You know, performance addicts tend to grow up in families where status is rated over character and achievement is rated over relationships. So they don't learn to be loved for who they are. They tend to be learn to be loved for what they do. So they're very worried about not performing. Even their sexual life becomes a performance, and they start comparing themselves to other people. They're constantly comparing and contrasting themselves to other people, as was done in their own families. But of course, our culture fits with this too now. I mean, we're the cosmetic capital of the world. We spent $9.4 billion on cosmetic procedures in 2003. The reality shows where you can be made over, you can be made have your face done so you can look like a movie star. I mean, we're bombarded with this appearance phenomena. Mm. And of course, in America, we believe that if we can achieve more, if we can have more material possessions, if we can earn more money, that somehow that's going to gain us more love and respect. And that people are so misguided in this regard that that's what their drive is. They're not really loving what they do. You know, they're not involved in the process so much. Mm-hmm. They're just so focused on the outcome.
Well, we certainly get a lot of drive from our environment telling us, you know, mm-hmm. what we have to do and
yes.
what we will be rewarded for.
Yes.
Certainly being jammed down our throats practically, literally, by the pharmaceutical companies and, you know, the glamour industry and all these things that we mention. And it does seem in the past 5 or 10 years that this whole type of phenomenon has been ramping up more and more, that we're getting more and more messages of our inadequacy and more methods by which we can spend our money to achieve that.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you, Martin, and I see an array of people from different walks of life, and I think this is affecting everyone right now. You know, it used to be in America that developing self-growth meant growing spiritually. Today it means perfecting your appearance and making more money. So it's really changed over time. Self-growth, the idea of growing and becoming more, has really come to mean looking differently. And we're so afraid of aging. I mean, we have this obsession with aging that we have to remain youthful. And, of course, that's where the cosmetic surgery issues come in. And it's created a problem. And I'm not taking a position of saying that all people who have cosmetic surgery have performance addiction or have a difficulty, but this is what really cosmetic surgeons call social perfectionists. There are people who are never satisfied, and once they start, they can't stop. The Michael Jacksons of the world, the Sharon Osbournes of the world, who's had $350,000 worth of cosmetic surgery, and she says she's addicted to it. She can't stop. Mm. She really looks at herself in the mirror over and over and always finds another thing that can be changed. And it's not changing internally, it's changing externally. And you can't solve an internal problem by changing the outside. It just doesn't work.
I find it interesting that we have this increasing fascination with reality shows. And yet, most of what we're being sold is illusion, is not reality, is visions of beauty that have been altered, that are just not really achievable or attainable by anyone. On our show here, Reality Sandwich, our tagline is a palatable taste of the truth. So we try to cut through that, some of that phoniness out there, and talk about real issues and some reality of what we're dealing with on a personal, emotional level, with the planet, with our environment. So let's talk a little bit about the curse of the capable.
Mm-hmm.
In that chapter, you have a 74-question questionnaire that folks can take to help self-identify if they're a performance addict. And in there, you ask us, the reader, to ask ourselves the question, or if we've asked or said this in our own mind, I will be lovable or respectful if blank, blank, blank.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, just for your listeners, just so they know that there's that performance addiction quiz, Martin, they can actually take that quiz free if you go to Amazon.com and just punch in performance addiction. The quiz is there free.
Great.
So it does give you a sense of where you stand in terms of this dilemma. What I mean by the curse of the capable is that these tend to be, performance addicts tend to be capable people. I mean, not necessarily affluent or tremendously educated. Some are, some aren't. But they're people who have capabilities. They just don't realize their own self-worth. And they're being driven by this idea that they have to achieve more and more. So they're constantly comparing and contrasting themselves to others. And, of course, their testing of others becomes a habit as well, because they don't really believe they can be loved for who they are. And that's where this curse comes in, because, you know, as they're growing up, I told a story in the book about a man who was an Olympic athlete, actually, and was going to be a physician, and father went to medical school, grandfather went to medical school, and the father was just unrelenting. He was such a perfectionist and drove his four sons incredibly, to the point where they became very self-conscious, pressured kids. And when his father actually, when he was a junior in college, his father actually committed suicide. And he said to me, you know, my father committed suicide because he couldn't perfect himself, he couldn't perfect his wife, and he couldn't perfect his kids. And this is a man that came to learn that even though he had become very affluent in business and he had given up the idea of medical school, he wanted to go his own direction, but he was always plagued by doing more, and that's the only way that he could maintain the love of others, because that's the environment he grew up in. That's what you were referring to earlier. What he's come to realize in the group experience is that people don't know how much money you make. They don't know what title you have in business or in the educational world. We're just relating to each other as human beings, and the people who have the status in the group are the people with the best interpersonal skills. And as people develop those interpersonal skills and take them out into the world, they realize that this is what makes them better performers and enjoying what they're doing, not just being focused on an outcome that sort of provides a relentless misery.
Would you say that certain celebrities deal with this? I'm just thinking, when you were sharing that story just now, I was thinking of that gentleman from Saturday Night Live a few years ago, I think, who ended up dying, Chris Farley, and I think years ago, John Belushi. I remember hearing some of their stories were that they were dealing with this own inner struggle that they could never really fully ever really be what the public believed them to be or was sold of them, and that they didn't feel that they embody that or own that in some way.
Well, celebrities are idealized, and they begin to realize that they're being loved for being idealized. So they try to live up to that image. I have a chapter in the book called Image Love in Your Relationships, and it's that state of disillusion that you were talking about as well, and trying to focus on the truth of what brings people happiness and love. And we tend to idealize our celebrities, and then we can't tolerate when they fall. You know, Alex Rodriguez, the great New York Yankee third baseman who has a number one average in the American League right now, admitted 2 weeks ago that he was seeing a psychologist for a couple of years, and the journalist who was interviewing him couldn't understand it. You know, he said, you're the best baseball player in the world, you have a beautiful wife, you have millions of dollars, how could you possibly see a psychologist? And he said, do you know how it feels to have to perform on this level day after day? And obviously the journalist could not understand that. Because he has the image, he couldn't understand that he had internal anxiety of getting up every day. And, I mean, they boo people when they don't perform on very high levels. you know, their Mariano Rivera, their relief pitcher, who's been an outstanding, probably the best relief pitcher in baseball, was booed a few weeks ago by New York fans because he had a couple of bad games. It changes very quickly, and if you get attached to being loved for an image, you try to live up to being an image, and of course, it's impossible. You know, there's only two choices in life, I think. You can either be perfect, or you can be human, and I've not met anyone who has attained that level of perfection.
And it seems that it's becoming more and more evasive. I mean, even today, things as ludicrous as pregnancy, women that are pregnant, and that being kind of seen as unacceptable or fat or not beautiful, and celebrities and models and women have been having babies for a long, long time, and they're beautiful when they're not pregnant, they're beautiful when they are, but today it's, oh my goodness, the moment that baby is done, you have to get back on a diet, you've got to be thin, you have to struggle to get back to being acceptable again.
Well, again, you see this tremendous pressure for women in the corporate world to get back to work because being a mother and raising a child is viewed as a secondary profession, not something that's all that important. And I have a chapter in the book called The Lure of Glamour, when looking good is never good enough. And, you know, this competitive and compulsive striving for beauty is the most outright evidence of performance addiction for women. We have the highest rates of eating disorders in the civilized world. Of course, we have the highest rates of obesity in the civilized world. So, yes, we're not being truthful. And I applaud you and Julie for, you know, the core of your show is to discover the truth. And I try to teach people that it's only the truth that sets us free and leads to happiness. Being able to tolerate the truth of our imperfections and also our strengths. And yes, I mean, how can you be critical of looking at a pregnant woman and being so preoccupied with her weight, or a husband focusing on that to an obsessive extent, and then women doing that to themselves? It just creates a degree of misery. It creates an addictive cycle that you can never free yourself from because it's not realistic. It's not the truth.
Where does the addiction come in? Is it... Do they become addicted to the need to try to be perfect, or once they are striving for that perfection, they become addicted to that process?
Well, the addiction comes in, Julie, with the idea that you have to, on a daily basis, try to perfect your appearance and try to perform on the highest level possible. There's not much room for making mistakes. You know, performance addicts tend to feel that if they make a mistake, they are a mistake. They don't realize that it's part of a learning process. It's what I call being a proactive learner. Someone who, you know, we make mistakes and then we learn from them, we correct them, and it's part of the joy of a learning process. But for performance addicts, there isn't much room for that. They have such fear that they're going to be criticized if they're not performing well or looking good that it really makes them quite anxious. So that's the addictive piece there. That's what's driving it. That's the heart of the matter.
You had mentioned the story about the boy who had the father who ended up committing suicide. And where does it come in as far as parents passing this down? Or are there certain clues or things that people can look at and say, I had those events happen in my life. Maybe this is going on for me, or I had these types of parents and that kind of thing.
Well, I think that in that story, this fella grew up in a world where status was more important than character, and his dad was incredibly critical of mistakes that he made, and also his siblings, so that he was really driven in a way. I mean, he was an Olympic athlete, and that wasn't enough, and he was a pre-med dean's list student, and that wasn't enough, and so forth and so on. You know, he recently, and I highlighted in the book that he told us a story in group about going to see his twin daughters play soccer. And, you know, when they were born, he actually took a business call and missed the birth. And you can understand how driven he was to do that. But as he's learned more about himself and what really can bring a sense of happiness, he went to this soccer game, and he said to me, "What should I do when I go? I can't help but yelling and pointing." I said, "Don't say anything. Just watch. Just watch and smile." So he watched and smiled, and he watched the girls, and he was saying to himself, "I can't believe they're having so much fun. Athletics was never fun for me because my father was standing in the corner with his arms folded, scowling, and I always was worried about what I was doing or how well I was doing." make a long story short, the girls jump in the SUV and they're driving home, and they said, "Dad, can you believe that Mr. Jones? He was yelling at his daughter all during the game, and what a jerk he is, huh?" And one of the daughters looked up and said that to him, and he said, you know, of course, to himself, "That could have been me." But he finally was enjoying the process. And performance addiction is a thief of simple pleasures. It really robs us of enjoying the moment, and because we're always trying to perfect our way into happiness.
And we're trying to achieve something outside of ourselves in a certain way, and then if we, I guess we believe that if we get it right, then we'll feel good.
Yes, I mean, that we're always chasing the rabbit, and what happens is you can catch the rabbit and actually feel worse. I mean, and that's when, you know, in my performance addiction groups, I have three groups. One is early 20s to early 30s. The other is early 30s to, say, mid-40s, and the other is mid-40s to 70. And in that older group, I have the people who have really gotten there. They have achieved so many things, but they're miserable because they realize that all this work, all this time, and all this effort, and it didn't bring them what they hoped it would. Mm. And that becomes very depressing. I mean, I tell a story in the book about a man, I labeled it reaching the top and hitting the bottom, because I had seen him 20 years ago when his adolescent daughter had made a suicide attempt, and it took me 3 weeks to even get him to come in for a session because he was traveling and business was so important to him and so forth. Well, we worked on helping the family somewhat, but ultimately I told him that I thought he was going to have a heart attack. I thought something was going to happen to him because he was so driven, and I really recommended that he spend time with his wife and slow down and so forth, and he never came back. And 20 years later he called me and told me that his wife had died of cancer. He didn't know what to do with himself because she sort of took care of everything, the kids and the finances, and ran the home, and he was building the business, in quotes, as you hear many men say. And he married someone on a rebound, and 6 months later, and was totally confused and depressed, and he finally came into therapy and talked about all the money he had, all the possessions he had, but he didn't have his wife.
Mm.
And he felt so guilty and regretful, and still to this day does. But to his credit, he comes to group every week, and we work at chipping away at this. But he has everything a person could want materially, but no relationship with his kids, estranged from his kids, and the guilt and regret about his wife, and he can't undo it now. And that's why I accent the immediacy of this. Don't wait for tomorrow to tell people how you feel. And don't wait for tomorrow to start looking at your life and what you're proceeding and what your belief system is. What you really believe will bring happiness. And that's part of what I try to focus on in that quiz.
Is this cultural phenomenon specific to certain countries or certain cultures, or is this something that is widely seen in all different types of people?
Well, it's really unique to American culture, Julie. I mean, Canada and Europe are close behind, but our collective mood in this country is clearly worsened. I mean, we have the highest rates of mood disorders, anxiety, and stress disorders in the civilized world, according to the World Health Organization, in the last 12 months. We have more absenteeism, more hours worked, less leisure time. And yet we're the most affluent country in the world, and we're the plastic surgery capital of the world. And Americans really are looking in all the wrong places for love and happiness. And because we're obsessed with money and appearance, we have a new religion. I call it the religion of perfection. And the only way we can recover for this is to defeat these two myths that in our society, that one is this obsessive pursuit of money doesn't bring happiness, that net worth doesn't equal self-worth. The second is that perfecting appearance, the idea that it's going to bring happiness and love, in fact, it creates addictive behavior. The truth is that happiness and love comes when relationships are more important than status and image. And when you develop those relationship skills, especially, as I mentioned before, the capacity for empathy, you're unquestionably going to feel more at ease within your own skin, more successful professionally and personally.
Now,
but it is a cultural syndrome that is unique to American society.
How pervasive amongst in American society?
Well, you know, I don't know, because obviously it's a new syndrome that I've tried to identify, and I don't have exact percentages. I can tell you, though, that of people that have taken the performance addiction quiz, and I've received, you know, numerous emails and, of course, from friends and colleagues and patients, most people score in the moderate to severe range. I mean, I think, Martin, you said you had a score of, what, 20?
Yes.
Yeah, so you're the minority. I don't know what Julie scored. Julie, did you take the quiz?
Yeah, I was in the bathtub, so I didn't get the full exact score, but I could probably count how many I didn't say yes to better than how many I did, so up there somewhere.
So you know just when you look at those questions that they pretty much affect most of us, and they're affecting children. I mean, I also wrote a chapter on parenting and performance addiction because I think the level of anxiety that we're passing on to our kids is enormous in this regard. And I really try to encourage parents to give their love, not their anxiety. I mean, don't create self-conscious, pressured children by teaching them that status matters more to you than character, because they'll take in your anxiety, but they won't feel loved. And then the cycle of performance addiction is spread to another generation. It starts all over again.
What are some of those things that parents do that are not helping in this area, and then what are some things parents can do?
Well, that's a very important question, Julie, because we want our children to reach their potential. This book is not about help, not about people not reaching their potential. It's about them enjoying the process. So we have to help our kids find things that they like to do and encourage them in directions that are natural for them. If you were a football star in high school and you want your son to be the same way, but he's interested in drama, let him be interested in drama. You have to learn to dance their dance. And that's what empathy is about. It's about reading people accurately, putting yourself in your child's shoes. One thing you want to teach them is that who they are is more important than what they do. Accent the character piece. That's the most important piece, because people with good character will achieve. And people with good character and good relationship skills, when you help children develop those relationship skills, being fair with others, not always criticizing the non-performers or the child that doesn't look so good, or when you hear your children make critical comments like that. And in terms of appearance, and this is very, very important for mothers, it's so hard for women in this culture not to make critical comments about their physicalness. Try so hard to not do that. We have relatives up here on vacation with us in Maine, and they were kidding that because for years, whenever I would compliment my aunt and say, "Gee, you look nice today," she would, because she lived with us when I was growing up, she'd always make a negative comment. And she said, "You know, I'm 58 years old, and I finally learned when people say, 'Gee, you look nice,' I say thank you." Because I used to say to her, even when I was in college, just say thank you. Don't elaborate on it. And, you know, girls grow up hearing these critical comments in their environment all the time. So, of course, they're going to mimic the same thing.
Right.
So try to teach them to use their bodies. And one of the assets for girls is that we have girls involved in so many athletics today, where they can really learn how to use their bodies, enjoy their bodies, and maintain a healthy weight. I mean, you know more about this than I do. Maintain a healthy weight through exercise and proper nutrition without having to develop eating disorders, which is so pervasive. I mean, we have two daughters who recently graduated from college, one this May and one last year, and the preponderance of eating disorders in their universities was just amazing. And it's so important that we address that very early.
Doctor, following on from Julie's question, I'd like to get a little bit more into what you call in the book the scene of the crime, and to talk just a little bit about some of the internal belief systems that get developed and the hard wiring that takes place, so that we can better understand this, such that we can then, you know, move into more of a discussion later on about how we shift this. So you talk in the book about, as you were talking with Julie, about parental influence and then cultural expectations and the messages of expectation that we take in, and then how that develops inside of us with respect to how we associate failures or anything less than perfection in our behavior as children and as we develop in our lives, and how we connect that to personal shame and feeling guilty and that we have to be more. Can you speak a little bit about how that hardwiring takes place?
Well, when I say hardwiring, Martin, what I'm really referring to is emotional learning. You know, and we learn in an emotional way, and also, of course, we learn in a cognitive way, but we learn certain things emotionally as children and as young people that are irrational, but they get encoded deeply in the brain. So if you're looking in a cracked mirror all your life, you develop a cracked reflection of yourself. And what I'm trying to say in terms of the hardwiring is You need to look into healthy mirrors today to find out who you are. We can't figure this out on our own. We're far too subjective. We need other people. It's an interactional thing, learning about ourselves. But some of us learned early. We heard we were called stupid, or we were called fat, or we were called unattractive, or I don't think it'll amount to much. We have to go back and re-examine who said those things, back to the scene of the crime, and what was the source of the information we were taking in. Because when you're young, you just take it in whole. You don't evaluate it and assess it. And what happens as an adult, this becomes part of our self-voice. It's the kind of ways that we talk to ourselves. Whether we talk to ourselves with an understanding self-voice or a punitive, or our self-voice is far too loose and doesn't demand much of us, it came from years ago. We took in what we heard from others, and that becomes a self-representation. And it's very difficult to change it. I've worked with models who are drop-dead gorgeous, who will come in and tell me, do you see this little line around my left eye? Do you see it under my eye? Or do you see that I have gray? And I can't even see these things. But these are people who literally are on the cover of magazines, but they have trouble believing they're attractive. Why? Because they've been so criticized, and they've tried to perfect their appearance so much that now they realize they're valued for looking perfect. So it becomes such a vicious cycle. So many of the things that could seem irrational, like you say to an intelligent person, well, you must know you're intelligent. Well, not necessarily. I treat MDs and PhDs who don't feel that they're particularly intelligent. And that's hard for people to believe, just like the Alex Rodriguez example, the star Yankee ballplayer who says he's anxious, and people say, how can you be anxious when you're leading the league in hitting? Well, because of the hard wiring that was integrated many years ago. It is irrational, but it can dominate your thinking. So you have to reexamine it today. Go back to the scene of the crime, consider the sources of the information you took in, who'd you take it in from, and were they clear representatives of who you are?
And this really connects to our deep, deep internal self-love. You, quoting from the book, you say here that we learn that we have to be more than we are, and that maybe then we'll be acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And that ties into another quote, is that we learn that we have to if we excel, then we can be loved.
Yeah.
So that this deepest inner notion that we strive for, to be acceptable, just to be okay, to have our existence be validated,
yeah,
is this becomes a carrot dangling out in front of us,
yeah,
that just cannot be felt.
Yes. Well, we all want to be loved. All human beings want to be loved. I mean, that's what motivates us. I consult to the corporate world, and when I watch managers and leaders interact with their staff, the role we played in our families have so much to do with what kind of leaders and what kind of authority figures we become. We all want that love and acceptance and respect. Unfortunately, many people, particularly in our society right now, are very misguided. And again, this is not to say that it's not important to make money. This is not to say that it's not important to actualize your potential. It absolutely is. If you don't become what you're destined to be, and if you don't actualize your natural talents, you'll be unhappy with yourself. You won't feel comfortable in your own skin. On the other hand, if you believe that your performance is the only thing you'll be loved for, you'll never actualize that potential.
Mm-hmm.
I have a musician who's extremely talented, is fairly well known in the country in his particular type of music. And no matter what happens, no matter what CD he cuts, no matter how many it sells, no matter which programs he's on, he still can't believe that he's that good. He grew up with a dad who was a musician, who was extremely critical, who was extremely intense, and unfortunately sometimes physical with him. So this is a person that if you watched him perform in front of a camera, you'd never know that he's anxious. You would never know this. But every night before a performance, he doesn't sleep. And that's where that hardwiring comes in, because he was hardwired so early to believe that you can't make a mistake. He's so afraid of making a mistake, he's not enjoying what he's doing.
Right.
It's not fun.
Right. Now, in the book, you share with folks questions and processes and about how to take a chunk out of this, how to shift this, how to begin to change our wiring, our belief systems. Can you mm-hmm. speak with us a bit about that? How do listeners that are resonating with some of this and they connect with the book, how do people begin to shift this?
Well, I think there's some clear steps that people can take. And again, not all people have severe performance addiction, but I think most people are affected by it somewhat. First step is slow down. You know, again, performance addicts are constantly busy. And the way to slow down is to focus on building those relationship skills, get lost in another person's world, use that capacity to empathy, and you take a mental vacation from your own troubles. Second step is stop criticizing. Performance addicts are constantly comparing and contrasting themselves to others, and unfortunately they do the same to their spouses and lovers and children. And learn that the only road to true love and true sexual intimacy is to give uncritical affection. The third step is to make self-care a priority. You know, performance addicts need to learn that the ability to take care of ourselves and those around us is the foundation for achieving genuine, healthy accomplishment throughout life, throughout a lifetime. I have a chapter, as you know, called Exceptional Mediocrity, and I use the word mediocrity because most of my performance addict patients don't follow proper nutritional guidelines, don't get enough sleep, probably drink too much, don't exercise with consistency, and don't foster their relationships with consistency on a daily basis. They see all of these things as secondary. They're not that important. And I call it exceptional mediocrity because how many people do you know who do all those things with consistency?
Right. Right. You provide some writing assignments.
Yes.
Which to me, I mean, this is my terminology, mm-hmm. Internal cognitive therapy. I'm calling it that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one in the chapter around glamour, love of glamour.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask the question, have you ever wanted to be drop-dead gorgeous?
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that particular exercise and how that... you know, someone who may be dealing with that?
Yes. Well, I really am trying to get people to use this book as a workbook and,
mm-hmm.
and to really examine and introspect a bit and share it with other people. But, you know, that question came from actually one of my clients who said all her life she wanted to walk in a room and be drop-dead gorgeous. And unfortunately, she went through some cosmetic surgery before she had met me, and it was botched and it didn't come out so well, and she's suffering from that. But the idea of always wanting to be that person that you walk in a room and people just look at you. And over time, I've helped her with her nutrition, and she's become part of group, and she's exercising regularly, and she just looks more vibrant. So one time she said to me, just answer me the question directly. I just want to know, am I ever going to be drop-dead gorgeous? And I said, probably not. Neither you or I are going to turn heads when we walk in a room. But you are attractive, you look very vibrant, and you're taking care of yourself, and that really means a great deal. And I think with your energy and the fact that you smile more now, you're going to attract more people. So it's trying to help people, especially in that chapter, The Lure of Glamour, for women to come to a realistic view of what they can be. Most of us are not drop-dead gorgeous, but there is a desire. You know, 24% of women in a recent survey said they would sacrifice 3 years of their life to be their ideal weight.
Mm.
And one of my patients said, I'd rather, who has gone from being obese to being, you know, a moderate frame and exercising on a regular basis, she said to me a few weeks ago, if I ever gain the weight back, I'd rather die. I'd rather die. I mean, just, you know, it becomes so severe because that's part of the hardwiring that many of these people have grown up with.
Right. Another thing that jumped out at me as I was going through the book was this this notion of love. There's a little section called What is Love? And you mm-hmm. talk about in love versus loving.
Yes.
And that it's difficult for some people to go from being in love to loving.
Yeah.
And can you talk a little bit about that and how that happens and how people with performance addiction end up in relationships like this, and how this affects them, and how they can work through it?
Yeah, well, performance addicts, they move past image. They have trouble moving past image love to real love. You know, they have tremendous difficulty loving because they base their own lovability on that daily performance, and they expect the same of their partner. So, the thing is, it's easy to fall in love. It doesn't really take much talent. I mean, we all know that. Hormones are driving, and that early binding and blinding effect of early sex makes you very attached to someone. But to love a real person, you have to come to know them. And when you really know them, that's what makes lasting love, and it's based on uncritical affection. But a lot of people never move past image love. They stay there because they fall in love with an image, and then the more exposure they have to the person, they realize the person has faults. And then when they realize the person has faults, they get disappointed and they start to feel more distant. We all have faults. And if we're going to have a secure, deeper sense of love and really love another person, we have to really know them and come to terms with their faults. But really, you tend to love people in a deeper way when you love their character. You love who they are. You love how they are with your friends, your family, with your children. You see their qualities that go beyond what appearance or a certain amount of money can provide. They'll get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and take care of a child. They go if they got a call at 3 o'clock in the morning, a friend was in the emergency room, they just get up and go there. They do those kind of things. Those are the people that we feel more attached to over time because we're coming to love their character. The fact that they squeeze the toothpaste out of the wrong end becomes meaningless. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that somebody's late 5 or 10 minutes most of the time becomes meaningless because we're more focused on character. The performance addict is so focused on image that if somebody changes the color of their hair or they cut their hair from long to short, they're thrown off by that. Or the man is no longer vice president, but he's been demoted and he's now a manager of a certain department, and the woman doesn't feel the same about him. That is not a deeper sense of love. That's not true love. That's image love. It's love based on a picture, a frame.
Then would you postulate a connection between performance addiction and a 50% divorce rate in the United States?
Oh, yes, unquestionably. Unquestionably. I mean, I do a great deal of marital therapy, and that's part of the reason that I identified this syndrome, because there's so much emphasis on appearance, men talking to women about weight or gaining weight, and as you mentioned before, the pregnancy issue, the distance that happens during pregnancy because there's not a real true understanding of what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And how a person does look and feel. There's a lack of empathy during that time. There's a lack of empathy for many women with many men who are high achievers because they thought they were going to bring them more or bring them that second home or bring them that sports car. That kind of talk, and then passing it on to their children. Of course, they end up, if they don't end up divorced, they end up with troubled teens. And the teens bring them into therapy, or the kids in middle school bring them into therapy because these kids are so pressured.
Right. There's definitely a difference, I feel, between getting married and being married.
Yeah.
The latter being a lifelong process that constantly is shaping and molding and morphing into all kinds of different things. Like, one's wife may go from having very long hair to having super short hair, in my case.
And we change so much over time.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that deeper love for a person's character, you can't tolerate the changes. I mean, we change physiologically, we change hormonally, we change our views. You know, Republicans become Democrats and vice versa. Things evolve. And isn't that the exciting part if you're really attached to someone?
In our last few minutes, I'd like you to just back up a bit and sort of look at us societally. I mean, we're obviously identifying something very significant here going on with our fast-paced, disattached American culture.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see this going? I mean, there seems to be, on the one hand, all of this is accelerating. It's getting worse, so to speak, with more images and more illusion and more things that we're ceaselessly striving for. Yet, I do sense, on the other hand, there is some, you know, movement of the yoga seekers of the world and the organic movement and people trying to find more of their internal selves at the same time.
Yeah.
So what's our promise or demise for the coming years, in your opinion?
Well, I'm optimistic, Martin, because I think, sort of building on what you just described, I see a movement as well, a parallel movement among so many people that realize that this isn't bringing them what they wanted. And I think there is an emphasis on better nutrition and exercising reasonably and having, I mean, everybody wants that quality, lasting, loving relationship. So I think that capable people, when they're more focused on the truth of what brings these things, they begin to change. And I think there is a movement in that direction because there's so much dissatisfaction. There's still people that are very taken in by the reality shows and the appearance and money factors, and we all are affected by it somewhat. But I think there's also a group of people that have been there, done that, and are teaching others that, look, this is not the way.
Exactly, and you are absolutely serving that, and I applaud you for that, and I appreciate your sharing your wisdom and time with us today on Reality Sandwich. We have been speaking with Dr. Arthur Sierra Micoli. Can you help me pronounce that correctly?
You pronounced it perfectly. I'm impressed.
Thank you. The book is Performance Addiction, The Dangerous New Syndrome, and How to Stop It from Ruining Your Life. And what's the best way for listeners to connect with you? Is there a website? Is there a...
I have a website. It's www.askdr.com. Ask Dr. Arthur, although the doctor is abbreviated. So www.askdr.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Much. Thank you, Julie.
And we will be back next Thursday with another episode of Reality Sandwich here. And I'm not exactly sure right now who our guest is. Do you know, Julie? But I think you and I will both be back.
Next week?
Yeah.
I want to say it's Sally Fallon, but I don't recall.
Okay, well, you can check...
It's a mystery guest.
HealthfulLivingSF.com for our upcoming guests. And we thank you for tuning in to 89.5 KPOO San Francisco. This has been Reality Sandwich. Every Thursday at noon, a palatable taste of the truth. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you.